Today's Teisho will be on case 34 in the Book of Serenity. Case 34 is entitled Feng Shui's Single Atom. Introduction: Bare-handed, empty-fisted, 1,000 changes, 10,000 transformations. Though this is making something out of nothing, what can you do? You employ the provisional to symbolize the real. But tell me, is there a fundamental basis or not? Case. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Zhuedo held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? Verse. As a graybeard rising from a hunt by the Wei River, how does that compare to those who starved in purity on Mount Shuyang? It lies just in a single atom, distinguishing changing conditions, fame and accomplishment. Both are hard to efface. Everybody here is very, very impressed by the sitting of people who are here for the first time. I know I'm impressed. And some of you are really here for the first extended period of sitting. And again, very impressive. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm definitely taking note of what you're doing, and it's really deeply inspiring to see people who are at Sesshin for the first time sitting so still and so wholeheartedly. I don't know what your secret is, but I'm really happy to see you practice so well. Of course, everybody else is doing a wonderful job too. You know. So the atmosphere couldn't be better for practice, really. When people practice together like this, amazing things can happen. If we were to do our sitting in isolation, I think it would be quite a different thing. You know, there are actually traditions in Buddhism where you would meet with a teacher and then you'd go back to your room and practice by yourself. But this system of practicing together, I just think is astonishing, and the results are quite amazing. I doubt most people could sit like this without this kind of a structure and this kind of intensive, focused sitting hour after hour. Almost like superhuman, really. It takes great energy and sustained attention. So we all benefit from this kind of a structure. And when people with good intentions practice together open-heartedly, it's like a miracle, really. It's quite extraordinary. I've been to sesshins at various places, and sometimes it's just chaos, you know. I remember going to a place in California with some friends of mine when I was just getting started in Zen, and it was like pandemonium. You know, people came to sesshin, and the more experienced people were at the front, in the front aisles, rows rather, and as you went farther back, more there were people who are less and less experienced, and there were almost constant movement, basically, people had taken cushions and they had just piled cushions up all around them, so that basically they couldn't find a posture they were comfortable with, so they had they had cushions for their legs and they had extra cushions here, and it was like some kind of a strange creature's nest, of all these cushions. And it didn't work, of course. Everybody was moving. It was, you know, so that was a memorable experience. You know, but here, people are sitting so well. It contributes to everybody's liberation. Everybody's making an effort for him or herself, but also those efforts help others be still and sit deeply. And so it's like a virtuous circle. You inspire me, I inspire you. I want to move, but I don't. So you want to move, but you don't. You know, and that's really the magic of this kind of collective practice. Nevertheless, I know how difficult it is to be on a first sesshin, and everybody here does. So when you look at somebody like Sandy or Gary or Kriti or Imtiaz sitting so beautifully, and you might think it's always been easy for them, and you might think the same thing for me, but we all start pretty much where, if you're a beginner, we start pretty much where you are, you know. My first sesshin was, really quite an experience. I hope many of you have heard this story, but I'm going to tell it again. You know, the woman who is now the abbot of the Los Angeles Zen Center was originally living in Seattle when I was there. Her name is Wendy Nakao. And Wendy, at that time, was doing Zazen with Webb Sensei. And Genki Roshi had just come from Japan. There was a Zen group that met on at the university, just like our group, where Webb was working as professor. And he had access to some rooms in the art building, and we would have a sit there every Wednesday or every Thursday, just like we do here in New Jersey. And I had been sitting at a Tibetan place, a Dharma Datu was what it was called, and there was no resident teacher there. So I was having tremendous problems with stress. You know, I was in graduate school. I was so tense all the time. The muscles in my head would get like the drum, like the skin of a drum. You know, they would get so tight. And I would go to these classes and you know, I'd be sitting in these classes with people who spoke multiple languages, and you know, we'd be talking about poetry, and then the professor would say, "Well, this is like Heidegger," you know, and he'd start talking about Heidegger, and then somebody would say, "Oh yes, you know, as Heidegger said," and then the German would roll off this person's tongue, and you know, and I would just be thinking, you know, maybe I should go back to being a cook, you know, in a restaurant, you know, I mean, I don't really belong here. And so on and so on. I would get tenser and tenser thinking about all this. So I had heard about this Tibetan place, and I went and sat there, and I had read some books on meditation practice, so they sit on some cushions, and I would watch my breath, and I would feel much better, but I didn't really have any guidance. So when I was there, I ran into this person whose name was Bill, who became a long-time friend of mine, Bill Kugler. And he said, "I hear this Japanese teacher has just come to Seattle. His name is Genki Roshi. And so he's meeting at the university on Wednesday nights." So I went to the university, and there was quite an active group there. And Genki Roshi was there. We had a sit, and I went through the sit, and just getting through 20 minutes was very, very difficult for me. I've been sitting on my own, but sitting formally somehow created more tension and rigidity in my body, and they would sit for maybe 25 minutes, half an hour. It was a little bit more than I could handle, and then they would do three sits in a row. And by the end, I was just like literally sweating on the cushion. The first, it probably wasn't the first time, but like the second or third time I went there, this beautiful Japanese American woman, Wendy Nakao, came up to me and she said, are you going to Sesshin? And I looked at her face and it was so beautiful. And I just thought, yes, I'm going. You know? And I said, what's a Sesshin anyway? So I signed up, you know. And it was a 7-day retreat, you know. And Genki Roshi had just come from Ryotakuji, so he wasn't used to working with Americans, right? He was used to training in a very formal Zen setting. So anyway, I went to this Sesshin, and we started out with 45-minute sits. And that was what they do at Ryotakuji, and that was what we were going to do. And Roshi wasn't trying to be difficult. He just didn't know, you know, what our level was. And it didn't take many 45-minute sits before I was really ready to collapse. You know, I literally, my legs hurt so much. It was like they were in, there was no posture I could get into that wasn't very, very painful, you know. And I remember going into the Dokusan room, and in the Japanese style, you're supposed to sit a seiza in Dokusan. You're supposed to sit with your legs tucked under you the way people do when they have tea, right? But there was no way I could do seiza. I went into the Dokusan room, and I literally sort of like crawled across the floor. And Genki Roshi must have looked at my face, you know, my suffering was like a mat. My face was a mask of suffering, you know. And he said, "I know you're in a lot of pain." And just hearing him say that was just like it just melted my heart, because I was in so much pain. And you know, that he acknowledged my pain meant a lot to me, you know. I was a pretty tough customer. You know, I worked construction all through college, and I dug ditches. I helped pour cement. You know, so I was used to physical labor, and I had hiked many 50-mile hikes. You know, I was used to privation. You know, and so on. But this was like harder than anything I had ever done. And you know, I was just like almost sobbing in the Dokusan room. After it was over, you know, I don't know how I got through 7 days. I just have no idea. It was just like a blur, right? A lot of discomfort, you know, a lot of pain. But there were a few moments when I felt extraordinary, and I didn't realize it at the time. It was only later that I realized something had happened that was not, quote unquote, normal, you know. I remember going into the washroom and watching water from a spigot trickle, fall down in a line onto the zinc surface of a sink, and the light was catching that light, and the light was catching the water, rather, the column of water. And it was glistening, and it just went through me. It was just like I felt this incredibly deep sense of peace, you know. And later, after the Sesshin, you know, when I came home, I just felt so liberated. And I didn't think, oh, I feel liberated. But I know now that sort of like the straitjacket of stress or tension that I carried with me all the time had been taken off of me. And it was like I could breathe freely. And it was like I could be spontaneously alive. Later I understood what had happened to me. All I knew at the time was that after the Sesshin, I felt really, even though the Sesshin had been so painful and difficult, and that there had been real tears, you know, sometimes I just cried, you know, because, well, it's complicated. But at any rate, you know, when it was over, I felt this tremendous sense of liberation. It was like I had taken off a straitjacket or something, and could move about freely, you know, and that just felt, that was something I had not, could not remember ever having felt, you know, since maybe early childhood, you know, and that liberation, that feeling of freedom was just so wonderful. That I decided to do another sesshin, even though it was so challenging. And I eventually became a really regular, very committed student of Zen. I mean, there were some odd moments after the sesshin. I remember I went in to teach my class after the sesshin, and I said something to my students, and I turned to the board, and the board, of course, was blank. And my mind went totally blank. I mean, that had never happened to me before. I had no, it was like, where am I? It was like waking up in a motel room. You know, sometimes you wake up and you think, wait, I'm not, am I home? No, you know, where am I? You know, it was like that. It was like, and I just thought, oh my God, my students are going to think I'm crazy, you know. But I had some notes in front of me. I sort of looked down and figured out what I was supposed to say, you know. But that was an amazing moment, you know. It was just like a mu entered my my mind at that moment. So you know, please realize that I'm sure you are having a lot of pain. You know, all I can say is that 35 years later, after that initial experience, I feel such gratitude for Zazen. For this beautiful path, which is really quite extraordinary. I mean, I don't think, you know, I had gone on, after finishing college, I had done many things before going to graduate school. I hitchhiked across the United States. I did a number of hikes in the Olympic Mountains and in the mountains of New Mexico. And I felt very good in those experiences, but there was something about sesshin which made me feel free, like in my bones, you know, like in my every atom of my being felt free, you know, that terrible pressure, that stress that we feel, or that pressure, I guess, or constraint, you know, was gone for a while. And it was possible to be like spontaneous and alive in a way that I had not been able to achieve without Zazen, you know. So please realize that, you know, everybody here has gone through what you're going through, you know, that feeling of like there's no posture I can get into that doesn't hurt is something we all know. And by the way, you'll notice that there are some chairs against the wall. And you know, if you are in agony on the cushion, you know, it's okay to just get up and sit in a chair for a sitting period or two, until you can, you know, focus more fully on your breath and you feel more composed and you're ready to go on. It's not a concession on your part to sit in the chair. It's not like holding up the white flag of surrender. You're just giving yourself a break, you know, from a very difficult routine. And, you know, sometimes people sit on the cushion and they might feel very boxed in and very, you know, like I can't focus on another breath. You know, my pain in my legs is too much. And if you get up and you sit down on the cushion, on the chair rather, you might notice that suddenly things become more spacious, you feel better, and at some point you might say, okay, I'm ready to get back down on the cushion. And pretty much everybody here has sat in a chair once in a while during a sesshin. So there's no stigma attached to this. Nobody's going to think you're a wimp or something like that, you know. Zen is really not about being tough. You know, it's not about being tough at all. You know, so please don't confuse this with, you will, unfortunately, you will go to Zen centers where you will meet people who are very, even, basically, Japanese people too, you know, who are very macho, you know, and they have this attitude like, you know, this is all about being tough, and they're quite benighted, you know, that's not at all, this would be really quite idiotic if it was about being tough, right? It's about being open. It's about being alive, and also it's about being responsive in a loving way to the world. You know, actually, you know, we create. You know, we didn't create it ourselves, but you know, as we're growing up, we all sustain injuries. You know, injuries. This is inevitably the case. You know, I have yet to meet a person who has not a sustained an injury in growing up, you know. And I don't mean falling off your bike. I mean an emotional injury, you know. You know, there may be such a person, you know, who has had the perfect life, but I suspect that all people have had things in their life that are traumatizing or that create a kind of, gradually create a kind of a shell, you know, a hard shell around us. And we create a kind of armor around ourselves, you know. So that it becomes harder and harder to be responsive and intelligent and alive because of our fear or our competitiveness, our envy, greed, and so on and so on, you know. So it becomes imperative at some point, you know, we create this armor or this shell around ourselves to protect ourselves, but then we can get locked in with our phobias and our anxieties and our neuroses, and it becomes, we're protected, but we're sort of like trapped in a very unpleasant place, you know. And so one way to think about Zen is that it's going to help you crack open that hard shell you've created. And when that happens, you know, you'll feel less stress and you'll feel more spontaneous and alive. As I said, I suppose there is some human somewhere who is totally well adjusted, etc., etc. But, you know, actually the Buddha had apparently a very nice life, you know. He had a loving father. He had... you know, basically everything he needed for material existence. His mom died, of course, when he was a baby. But you know, so there was an injury there, right? Mother died, and basically we're told he grew up in a world without where he wasn't exposed to sickness, old age, and death. But I've always thought that story can't be right because, you know, I suspect that something about sickness, old age, and death really troubled the Buddha. And some people wouldn't have been troubled. You know, some people would have just said, oh, well, you know, at least I'm not sick. You know, at least I'm not old. You know, at least I'm not dead. So, but it really bothered the Buddha. So I think maybe he too had had some kind of an injury that, you know, these things made these things resonant for him. But most of us have injuries, and we get closed up, we get boxed up, and then we get trapped. And Zen is like, you know, when you're in that pain sometimes, you can sometimes crack open, you know, and it's really quite wonderful, actually. You know, I've talked about this before, but my brother, when he was growing up, had a number of injuries. We had a difficult life in a lot of ways, and my brother became a very cynical person. He was extremely a handsome person, and he was quite a charmer, and he was he had a veneer of humor. He could be incredibly witty and funny, but his humor was very deeply cynical. And my brother was sort of like a funny, cynical guy, witty, but it was hard to get to see the real person, you know, after a while. And I remember my brother had a crisis. His wife had an affair, and he became aware of it. And he had like a nervous breakdown, actually, you know. And it injured him so deeply that he really just like cracked open. When this happened to him, he called me on the phone, and he was just, when he discovered that his wife had cheated on him, and he was sobbing into the phone, but when we talked, it was like my long lost brother, because he was so open hearted. It was like, Peter, where have you been for the last 15 years? And he was just so loving and kind, because in a way this shell he had constructed had been cracked open by this terrible betrayal. And for a period there of several months, I was like, I found my old brother. And it was so beautiful to see this inside this person who had been so cynical and closed up. There was this loving, kindly person I had not seen peeking out for many years. And then actually my brother, he sort of quote-unquote recovered. And after about 6 months, he was on the phone and he was yakking away, and he was his old wisecracking self and making jokes about socialism and so on. He was a very conservative, politically conservative person, and so he was digging at me because of my left-wing politics, and that was the Peter I had seen more often, you know. So for a moment there, kind of a crisis situation cracked him open, and inside there was this beautiful, loving, there was a Buddha inside, And for a minute I saw it, and then, you know, after about 6 months it closed up. It didn't really open up again until he was very ill, you know, and he eventually died. That kind of openness can be produced by a great crisis, but it doesn't have to happen because of a great crisis. It can happen on the cushion, you know. So we're sitting with our obstacles. We're sitting on the cushion, trying to wake up, and it's very strenuous, and we can be in a lot of pain. The interesting thing, though, is that sometimes you can crack open like that, and suddenly you feel this very powerful compassion, great sensitivity, and connectedness to things. And this is really a very precious, you know, a very precious moment. So maybe you're cracking open a little bit on the cushion, or you might. And nobody likes to be cracked open, you know, but when it happens, it's quite beautiful. And usually this amazing thing comes out, you know, this really wonderful thing. We often imagine that when we crack open, there might be a monster in there or some kind of a bad animal, but actually inside there's just this great beauty, this radiant energy and kindness. So please believe me when I say that. However, nevertheless, even though this is true, it's not a good thing to be constantly in pain with no resources. So please don't go out of your way to be in pain so you can crack open, okay? Don't do that, okay? You'll crack open anyway, you know. So there are some pain management strategies, and they're related to this koan. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. You might think, well, what does that have to do with Zen? Who cares about the nation? And so on and so on. But this is really about how to deal with any kind of problem in life. You know, setting up a single atom means being aware of the moment. See, the moment. When you sit down on the cushion, you have about a 25 to 30 minute period you have to get through. And if you think about it as a 25 or 30 minute period, especially when your legs are killing you, it's like psyching yourself out, you know. And you can be halfway through a meditation period and you can feel like you're on a tightrope and you're going to fall off the rope at any minute, you know. And you look at the other end of the line and you think, my God, that's 100 yards away. I'll never make it, right? So don't approach it that way. You know, don't think, I've got to get through another half hour. You take it literally one moment at a time, you know. So when you sit down on the cushion, you don't have to get through 30 minutes. You just have to get through one breath. This sounds trivial, it sounds like, but this is very, very important. You know, this is like the foundation of Zen practice. That you don't have to get through a lifetime, you don't have to get through multiple lifetimes, you don't have to get through a kalpa of lifetimes, you know. You just have to get through one breath, you know. And so if you can do that, you know, you should give yourself a big pat on the back, you know. So, you know, when you come in to sit down, it's just a new sit, you know, the worst thing you can do if you're not in pain is to doodle around in your mind and start thinking about this and that. Because about 10 minutes into the sit, you will be uncomfortable, you know. So please get ready, right? So when you come in and you sit down on the cushion, you want to focus on your breath right away. And you want to focus on the breath goes out, and then it's gone, see? And if you're really focusing on the breath, you'll probably notice that when you're following the breath out, if you're single-mindedly focused on the breath, your pain recedes. It'll recede. And then when you run out of breath and you take another breath, you'll probably notice your pain comes back. So you know, you sit down on the cushion, you straighten your back, you're watching the breath, you breathe out. The breath goes out, and then it's gone. And then at the end of that interval, you might feel pain. And you come back to the breath again, and you follow the next breath out. And as you're exhaling and you're focusing on the breath, the pain will diminish, you know. If you're working with a mu koan, this effect can be even more powerful. So, you know, you say, mu. See, when you're doing that, if you're really focused on mu, you'll notice the pain recedes. It may almost disappear and until the end of the breath, and then the pain comes back a little bit. So if you want to think of it this way, you're sweeping the pain away, and then it comes back. And you're sweeping the pain away, and it comes back. And you're sweeping the pain away, and it comes back. This process can go on for a long time, and pretty soon, you know, the bell is going to ring, and 25 minutes will be over. You just have to get through one breath at a time. So, just you get through this exhalation, then this exhalation, and you just give each moment of a breath your full attention, if you can. And when you sweep the pain out, it will recede. What's going to happen eventually is that each time you sweep the pain away, you're going to notice that, maybe not at first, but eventually you'll notice that your consciousness is changing. Your mind is becoming much more still and emotionless and actually empty. And so as you're sweeping away the pain, you're actually deepening your concentration. And so this will work, and the more it happens, the more powerful your ability will be to deal with your discomfort. So you use the breath to sweep the pain away, use the breath to sweep the pain away, use the breath to sweep the pain away, and it's like your mind is going down, 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 down into deep concentration. And it might not happen at this sesshin, but eventually, you will find a place which is absolutely still and immobile and imperturbable. You know, and it will be as though you know about the eye of a hurricane, right? That a hurricane hits and it tears everything up. There's torrential rain, there's thunder, and so on and so on. And then all of a sudden, you look out your window and the sun is shining, and you think, oh, that's over. And then the hurricane comes back because it's got a circular structure. And in the eye of the hurricane, it can be sunny and bright. Well, actually, when you follow the breath down, down, down into into deep concentration, you'll eventually get to this place which is like that. It's imperturbable. It's absolutely still. And if your pain does not totally disappear, it will seem to be much less of a problem. And eventually, you will actually reach a state which is a painless state. I remember reaching that state after a number of years of practice. We were having a sesshin in a place called Moses Lakes in Washington State. And it was really quite an amazing sesshin. It was out in the eastern part of Washington State, which is very much sort of like high desert. And we were sitting, it was a state a camp with cabins and a big room where we were doing, where we had our zendo. And every night we'd go to bed and the coyotes were howling. It was really cool. It was very hot though. It was over 100 every day. But I remember one day sitting on the cushion and all of a sudden it was like the pain just disappeared. I was just astounded. And I went into Dokusan and I said to Genki Roshi, I said, Genki Roshi, now the most amazing thing has happened, my pain is gone, And he laughed, and I said, I'll never feel pain again, Of course, the next day I was in agony again. But I had gotten into that state, where the pain really did disappear, and it was like a miracle. It was astonishing, Eventually, you won't have much pain when you sit. I mean, I've been doing this for 35 years, and I assure you, if it were like the first sesshin, I wouldn't be here. It becomes much more manageable. I don't have, I really very rarely have any pain at all of the kind I felt when I was starting to sit, mostly I'm just having a good time. Please trust the process. Just as in sesshin, you need to trust the sesshin process. You need to trust the moment by moment awareness. Atom by atom awareness. And when we're not in the moment, that's where the trouble arises, right? As long as you can keep bringing your mind back to the moment, everything is going to be quite good. And by the way, this is true for advanced people too. When you're starting your zazen, you're struggling with physical pain, and this is so important because there's something brute about pain, right? It's just brutish and crude, and it won't negotiate with you. This sort of thing. I remember Genki Roshi telling a story about this very famous French philosopher who had come to sit at Ryotakuji, and about 2 days into the sesshin, he left, and he told the teacher, "You have crushed my philosophy." The pain just crushed his structures of ideas that he was living his life by. And so that guy was living in a kind of fantasy, actually, you know. If you run from pain, you'll be running all your life, right? So there really are many people who are very, very pain averse, and they would do anything. They'd turn their brother into the Gestapo, that kind of thing, because they're afraid of being in pain. But we can be afraid of pain in other ways too that aren't so dramatic. But you know, when you pull back from things that are challenging and cause you discomfort, you're living, you're really boxing yourself in. So, getting the pain right out on the table is really important. You know, it's really like, okay, there's pain, you know, but there doesn't have to be suffering. See, what's the difference? Well, pain is when your legs hurt. Suffering is when you can't deal with it, right? You don't know how to enter a bigger mind, you know, and that causes distress and suffering. But, advanced people don't have physical pain. They have psychological. They're dealing with their psychological obstacles. And they can be, they don't feel like somebody's pulling your legs out of their sockets, but they do hurt just as much in a way. You know, and here too, if we don't face our obstacles, you know, we're going to be boxed in. You know, we're living a very fake life, you know. So, the Buddha said, you know, one of the first things the Buddha said was, you know, life is suffering, you know, to be alive is suffering. And that, you know, he didn't start by saying, it's all bliss, man, you know, it's all bliss, you know. He said, basically, you've got to deal with the fact of suffering if you want to get anywhere. And he put it right out there on the table. And sitting, you know, puts the, you know, crude pain right out on the table, you know. And you have to deal with it. You know, if you run from suffering, you'll run all your life. You know, most things in life require some pain. Most things worth doing, you know, it's just true. People who have children, women don't get kids without pain. You know, the beautiful lives they bring into the world, you know, there's a price, you know. And there's other prices too that people have to pay, you know, for that. Your children don't always love you, they don't always thank you, and so on, you know. But anything else, you know, if you look at the extraordinary work that, the hours people put in the sciences, you know, those are all hours that, you know, they're sitting in the lab, they could be, you know, somewhere having a Mai Tai, you know, but they're in the lab, you know, and the thousands of hours people put in doing science or doing, art. You know, basically, people work in obscurity their whole lives, and they don't make a dime, and yet, you know, they keep painting, they keep writing. You know, so most good things require some pain, and that includes human relationships, right? Most human relationships involves some agonizing moments, right? It's going to happen. You know? So, whether you're dealing with physical pain in its brutish, crude form, you know, or you're dealing with the psychological pain, which is really much harder to deal with, you know, actually. If you back off from it, you box yourself in. You know, so Zen is really like is thought of as there's in Tibetan Buddhism too. There's long path and there's a direct path. You know, something like Dzogchen is the direct path, and in the Mahayana, Zen is the direct path. Right. So basically, you know, we start with, you know, sitting a lot. It hurts. You know, you have to get over yourself. You know, your small self. And then many wonderful things happen. And when you encounter your obstacles, you know, your psychological obstacles, you want to pull back, but you know you can't grow without working through these. You know, so to be a Zen person, you have to have that kind of personality where you're willing to confront your obstacles. And not everybody has that characteristic, you know. But it's, you know, sooner or later you have to do it. It might take 50 years and it might take 10 years, you know. And the Zen is the 10-year plan, right? So sooner or later, have to do it, you know. So why not sooner, you know? So everybody's doing a wonderful job, really wonderful. And remember what I'm saying. You only have to take it one moment at a time, you know. And this goes for advanced practitioners too. You know, when we confront our psychological obstacles, they can seem to extend forever and ever, right? I mean, it just seems like I'll never get out of this box, right? You know, I've been going around in these loops all my life, you know. And no sooner do I break out of one loop than I find another loop, you know. And it can seem interminable, you know. But you just have to take it one breath at a time, one loop at a time. Every time you break a chain, you know, a link in the chain, you're free, right? And you can say, but I have so many chains, you know. Well, you know, you have to start breaking them sometime, right? So, you know, each time you take away one link, you're freer. And you feel better. You feel, generally speaking, you feel better. You know, maybe not as you're working it through. I can remember Genki Roshi was an old-style Zen priest. So he was almost insane sometime in his willingness to have us sit forever. And he did have a kind of warrior spirit that I don't recommend, you know. And sometimes we would sit until, you know, it was just like I would leave the zendo and my teeth would be chattering, right? And I don't recommend that. I really, please do not do that. You know, please do not do that. When you're in agony like that, it's not productive. Nevertheless, I'm not taking it back. Don't do that. But nevertheless, you know, I would leave the zendo with my teeth chattering. And I would be on my way to bed, but I would feel like I was the freest person in the world. You know, I would feel so alive and so free. And I had never felt like that before in my life, you know. So there's something about this staying in the moment. Just take it one breath at a time. That's the key. And all the other stuff is just the past is really past. You have to deal with it. You have to deal with it when you're working through your obstacles. And the present isn't here, you know. But the focus when you're in the moment, pain. When you're in the moment, suffering ends. When you're fully 100% in the moment, you know, we want to be in some other moment, either in the past or in the future. And that creates suffering. That creates stress and fear. But when you're 100% in this moment, suffering stops. That's what the Buddha said, and it's the truth. You know. So please be 100% in the moment. That's the secret. And it's not easy to do what we're doing, you know. Everybody has different sets of challenges. You know, I always had a huge amount of pain. Zazen used to upset my stomach until last month, as a matter of fact. Sometimes when I was first starting out, Zazen would so upset my stomach. I would have such an incredibly upset stomach, you know, and my digestion during sesshins was never good. It would just be awful sometimes. But I would feel so good. I thought, you know, I had to balance, you know, okay, you know, my digestion is going to go to hell, but on the other hand, I'm going to feel so wonderful, you know. And lately I've found out that acidophilus pills help a little bit, and indeed they do, you know. And the brown rice helped me a lot also. But you know, I would say even though sometimes it was very, very difficult to deal with the physical dimension of Zen practice, I felt liberated in so many ways. And so I wouldn't change a thing. And now we are going to do some more Zazen. So you're all practicing wholeheartedly. It's really deeply inspiring to see. And it's an honor to sit with you. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Shui Do held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? In other words, you know, life or death, you know, just be in this moment. Whatever happens is going to happen, but be 100% here now. Verse, as a graybeard rising from a hunt by the Wei River, how does that compare to those who starved in the purity on Mount Shuyang? It just lies in a single atom, distinguishing changing conditions. Fame and accomplishment are both hard to efface. So it's a don't worry about what people think, don't worry about right or wrong, good or bad, just be here. That's the point.